From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, Defense Secretary Jim Mattis said he's directed the Pentagon's watchdog group to examine the Air Force's failure to report the Texas church shooter's 2012 domestic violence conviction to the FBI. That would have prevented the shooter from buying guns. Also today, Texas District Attorney Audrey Lewis announced that caskets are being donated free of charge for the funerals of the 26 victims of the massacre, and that a crime compensation fund will give each family $6,500 to cover funeral expenses. David Brown is covering this story for KUT. He returned to Austin late last night from Sutherland Springs. So, David, tell us more about the latest in the investigation. There's word of a cell phone?
Yeah. What we are hearing now, Robin, is that the shooter did have a cell phone and that officials have retrieved the shooter's cell phone, but they are not able to actually access it because it's locked. And so they're going to do their best to, obviously, they believe that there's a treasure trove of information. They also believe that the shooter, Devin Patrick Kelly, and we'll get back to his name in just a moment because I think that factors in here. Mm. He apparently called his father while he was leaving the scene of this horrific incident. He was being chased by a couple of bystanders who had intervened and who are being called heroes here in Texas. In any event, he called his father and said that he knew he was going to die. Shortly thereafter, his vehicle hit an obstruction, and he was pronounced dead at the scene. Originally, it wasn't clear whether the bystanders' bullets, the people who were pursuing him, in fact, had shot him and killed him. It appears he died by his own hand, but in fact, he had been shot in the leg and torso by those bystanders who interrupted the massacre at the church.
Well, so obviously, they want to know more about the phone calls that he made, but you mentioned the shooter's name, and we're not going to, or if we do, we'll do it infrequently, as you just did, because investigators in Sutherland Springs have made the decision not to use his name. Here's Texas Department of Public Safety's Regional Director, Freeman Martin.
What I can tell you is today the autopsy was performed on the shooter, and if you notice, I use shooter instead of the suspect's name. We do not want to glorify him and what he's done.
Research shows that saying the name of a mass shooter inspires others who want their names known. What are people there saying about that?
It's interesting because this is part of, I mean, to be honest, the back of this, and I'm sure you realize this, Robin, it's part of a push by a group of victim families and law enforcement officials. And they've been upset about the way that shooters are glamorized by the repetition of their names in the news media. This is a conscious choice, as you point out. Texas and, in fact, FBI officials are making this decision, not going to hide his name, but we're not going to encourage others by amplifying the name at all. And so, of course, a lot of people, as we were talking about a little bit earlier, very upset, though, over the fact that his name did not show up in a National Criminal Information Center database.
Right. What's been the response there to that news that he had a long history of domestic abuse, including this military conviction, fracturing an infant's skull, which would have prevented gun purchases? It was an error on the part of the Air Force. What are people
exactly
saying?
I'll be honest with you. People here aren't talking about those sorts of things. This is that's very much a conversation outside of Sutherland Springs.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis has said he wants the Pentagon's watchdog to find out how this could have happened. And we're also hearing from Republicans and Democrats in the House in particular saying they want to know how this shooter slipped through the cracks. And it does appear to have been some kind of fault in the transference of information from the Air Force, which has under its own rules, are supposed to be transferring that information to the FBI so it can appear in the database. To be honest, we have five people still being treated at area hospitals. Their conditions range from serious to critical. And officials here have been really respectful of family privacy. And that's a big thing when the number of reporters amassed, seemed to outnumber the actual residents.
Hey, look, we still have one other really big question. Your Texas governor there, Abbott, said that the shooter was denied a concealed handgun permit. Now, as we just said, his name didn't get into the federal database, so he could buy guns without showing up there. But why was he denied then the handgun permit?
I have to tell you, the concealed handgun permit in Texas, this is not an easy thing to get. I'm not sure what the narrative is about the concealed handgun permit, but it is a very in-depth background check. And it's not just a background check. It's, of course, they obviously access the FBI database and such, but they ask a series of very pointed questions and do a much more thorough background check than the sort of background check that you're going to get at a retailer selling guns. There's just really no comparison. The background check to obtain a license is anywhere from 2 to 3 months, sometimes longer.
Be interesting to see, do some research and see what they found that alarmed them enough that he didn't get that permit.
And officials right now just aren't saying that. Right. We're going to be learning a whole lot more in coming days.
David Brown, host of the public radio show The Texas Standard, covering the Sutherland Springs church shooting for KUT there. David, thanks.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, we're also watching Congress this week, where House Speaker Paul Ryan says Republicans are on track to pass their tax overhaul bill by Thanksgiving. Ryan spoke this morning about the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that's making its way through the House Ways and Means Committee this week.
The Joint Tax Committee says it's a tax cut for everybody across the board. But most importantly, we know it levels a playing field for American job creators so they stay here. It levels a playing field for our businesses so they don't ship jobs overseas anymore. And it gives hardworking taxpayers in the middle the kind of relief that they need to get ahead, the peace of mind they need so they can plan.
For more, we're joined by NPR congressional reporter Kelsey Snell. Kelsey, Speaker Ryan says the bill is on track. What's your sense? Can the House really pass this by Thanksgiving?
Yeah, I've been speaking with House Republicans over the past several days, and they say that they are generally okay with this bill. There are, of course, some holdouts, particularly Republicans who represent states like New York, New Jersey, and California, these high-tax states that would be hit by some of the provisions in the Republican bill, namely a provision that would cap the amount of mortgage interest that people could deduct and would get rid of many of the tax breaks for state and local income taxes. But on the whole, Republicans seem prepared and just very excited to see a tax bill in general. So it is very conceivable that this could pass the House by the end of next week.
You mentioned some of the Republicans who are against this bill because of what it would do to state and local tax deductions. There are also Republicans who are upset about how much it's going to add to the debt.
Yeah, there absolutely are. Though I would say that many of the Republicans I've spoken to about the debt in specific say that they are confident that cutting taxes, particularly cutting taxes for businesses, will grow the economy in a way that it will be sufficient to make up for any additional, any additional adding to the deficit and adding to the debt. They're very, very confident in the economic theory of that essentially is similar to the trickle-down economics that we saw during the Reagan years. They say that if we give businesses a greater opportunity to grow, they will create more jobs, create more economic growth, and the entire economy will grow as a result.
And as you know, a lot of economists say that that is nonsense, really, and it hasn't worked in the past. But we'll see how that argument goes on. Meanwhile, the Senate is going to release its version of the bill this week. Do you expect it's going to look much like the House version?
Yeah, we are expecting to see that bill probably sometime on Thursday, maybe in the afternoon. I do think that on the business side, particularly the international business side, we should see the bills look almost identical. The places where you'll see some changes are probably on the individual side and the way the Senate wants to treat small businesses. Those small businesses, particularly that we call pass-throughs, they are the ones that file their taxes on the individual side of the tax code. So we should probably see some changes, particularly in the mortgage interest deduction, where the Senate has very different view on the way that should be handled. You have to remember that a lot of Republicans in the House represent areas that are they're very similar to one another. But when you're a senator, you're representing an entire state. So you may not have people with the same income brackets or the same concerns, and they have to look out for slightly less parochial concerns.
The Tax Policy Center said yesterday that the bill disproportionately rewarded the richest Americans, but then later it retracted its report because of an accounting error. What happened there?
Yeah, the Tax Policy Center said that their staff found an error in the preliminary tables that they released, and it was based on some additional child tax credit components that they hadn't considered. So they retracted their original assessment. They can't say exactly how much those original assessments will change, but they expect to send something out maybe later today.
Does this matter? Do people pay a lot of attention to what the Tax Policy Center says about the bill?
Yeah, I think it does matter because it opens them up to criticism that in the past they were able to avoid. They've been considered a fairly bipartisan or nonpartisan organization that is known for doing very reputable analysis of tax issues. This could put them in a position where if Republicans or Democrats wanted to object to their studies, they could point to this mistake. Though I've spoken with many members who said that they still have a general faith in the work that they did, and they appreciate that TPC owned up to the mistake as quickly as they did.
We spoke with former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers about the tax plan yesterday, and he echoed some of the criticism that we've heard, which is that the plan really benefits the wealthy and not the middle class. Here he is.
That's why I'm so sorry to see the budget gimmicks contained in the plan that cause it to help lower and middle income families in the first year, but then cause those benefits to be removed very quickly over the next half dozen years, whereas the breaks for rich people mushroom over time.
Kelsey, how are Republicans responding to that criticism?
One of the things that I'm hearing from a lot of staff is that some of these tax breaks that are set to expire in the bill won't actually expire because Republicans and Congress in general don't like to approve the elimination of a tax cut, because eliminating a tax cut is almost the same as saying I'm increasing your taxes.
Right.
So they say, have no fear, these tax breaks will go on in perpetuity.
Kelsey Snell at NPR. This is Here and Now.
When EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt recently declared the war on coal over, he kicked off the Trump administration's effort to eliminate the Obama-era Clean Power Plan, which required states to reduce climate-changing carbon dioxide from coal-burning power plants. The Obama plan, applauded by environmentalists as the first national limit on carbon pollution, has actually never gone into effect. It's been tied up in courts by those who don't applaud it, including the coal industry, which supported the 24 states filing suit. Now, the Trump administration is expected to face lawsuits from environmentalists seeking to reinstate some of those protections. For the view from one state, and an important one, let's bring in the governor of Wyoming, the state that produces the most coal in the U.S. Wyoming Governor Matt Mead joins us from Cheyenne, the beautiful capital. Governor, welcome.
Thank you very much, Robin. I appreciate the opportunity to be on.
Well, give us some context here as we start this conversation, just where you stand on these many issues. Do you believe in human-caused climate change, which these rules were meant to reduce?
Well, let me just give a little more context in terms of Wyoming. We actually consider ourselves, and I think rightfully so, the energy state, and that we export more energy than any other state. We have gone through, in my time in office, I'm in my seventh year now, we've gone through and seen what the President Obama's view was on this and President Trump's view on this. And what my message has consistently been is, listen, if you want to be the number one exporter of energy, if you want to be the number one exporter of coal, which we do and we proudly are, we need to double down on what we're doing in the state of Wyoming. The debate in terms of climate change and how it is caused rages on, and I think largely it's been a chance for us on different sides to call each other names, but I've tried to move the state of Wyoming past that, and the way I've done that is said, listen, it doesn't, you know, your personal views on this are certainly important to you, but the world, our customers, believes that climate change is real and that CO2 is a contributor. So let's get to work. And so we have asked, I asked the legislature to help us in that. I'm proud of a couple of facts. One, we are now looking at an integrated test center that we're partnering with the XPRIZE Foundation on. It's a $10 million prize to see who can not only capture a lot of flue gas coming off a new coal-fired plant, but then how you use that CO2 in a productive way for a different type of product.
Well, in fact, as you've been saying, last year after the Supreme Court put the Clean Power Plan on hold, as we said, it's been held up in the courts, you were one of a handful of Republican governors who decided to move ahead with meeting the requirements anyway. Your state is the only Western state that's close to hitting the Clean Power Plan state goals for carbon emissions.
Well, that was one of the problems I had with the Clean Power Plan is where's the baseline? We didn't feel like we had gotten credit for the improvements that had been made to our coal-fired plants. And as we are now with the change in administration, we're very pleased that, we now have the ability to have new coal leases. The moratorium has been lifted on coal leases. But regardless of who's in the White House, we want a long-term plan for the state of Wyoming to make sure we can produce our coal for the next 100 years. And for that, We have to be a leader not only in production, but in solutions for coal.
Well, as I said, you have been adhering to the Clean Power Plan goals, and you have done quite well. But there's a little bit of a disconnect because you have said you are unconvinced that climate change is man-made. And yet here you are kind of leading the charge, even when the plan wasn't enacted, was held up in the courts to do, as you just said, to make sure it's the cleanest production possible. Is there a disconnect there?
I don't think there's a disconnect, Robin, because regardless of my personal beliefs, I was just over in Taiwan several weeks ago. I've been to Japan, South Korea. These countries want to participate with us in buying our coal, but they also want solutions. So as a state, we can say, well, we disagree where you're coming from politically and your views in regard to climate change. And they get to say, well, then we're not going to buy your coal if you don't help us provide solutions. So for me, it's our customers, the nation, the world, are looking for solutions with regard to CO2. And I think it's an opportunity for the state of Wyoming, as we want to produce our coal for, as I said, 100 plus years, to provide that leadership.
Okay, let me take a couple pieces there. You say provide coal for 100 plus years. You said also you want to double down on the state's commitment to the coal industry. But the Census Bureau points out that the coal industry nationally, across the country, employed only about 76,000 people in 2014. That's fewer than Arby's employs. And we've read somewhere only 6,000 in Wyoming. And this includes this isn't miners. These are people working the desk jobs. This is all the jobs. You know, the president says he's going to bring back coal jobs, but it looks as if the jobs are going away. Why stick so to an industry that the market even seems to be moving away from?
Well, I have a broader vision than that, not just for coal-fired plants. It's an opportunity to look at enhanced oil recovery through CO2 floods. It's an opportunity to see how we can otherwise use coal as a resource. At the University of Wyoming, they're breaking down the different chemical components of coal to see what else coal could be used for. Coal has an opportunity for in-situ gasification. It produces a syngas. And we have had and we will have again coal bed methane, which is produced from deteriorating coal. There is lots of opportunities for coal in addition to using it to produce electricity.
You also have the natural gas industry, which is growing. And some say that's what's been, you know, reducing the coal industry, not regulations that didn't even get kicked in. It's the fact that there's this competition. Wyoming is also one of the top natural gas producing states.
We are, and we're very proud of that as well. But there's no question gas has been a big competitor with coal, and that's why you see some of the fuel switching. But you also see it because, in addition, in my mind, the rules and regulations, particularly the Clean Power Plan, companies have to make, you know, $500 billion, multi-billion dollar investments for, you know, a 30, 50-year period of time. They need to know that they can actually build a coal-fired plant and get it done. And when there's uncertainty as to how you go about that, I think that's also led to some of the fuel switching that we've seen.
Some say that it's the Trump administration now that's adding to that uncertainty. There has been no replacement for the Obama plan. And there are some, including Vicky Arroyo of the Georgetown Climate Center at Georgetown Law School, who says that's the EPA's plan. Scott Pruitt definitely doesn't think that there's human-caused climate change, and he's just kicking this down the road. And even some in the industry have been really concerned, and some states who maybe didn't like the Obama plan, as you said, thought it was overreach, want something because they're going to get sued if there's no replacement.
Well, and I think there will be a replacement. I think that the legal system has made clear there needs to be a replacement. I think that the difference is, as the EPA works on this, it'll be what we can do in the so-called inside defense, and meaning what the power plant itself can do to address this versus trying to address it more broadly with you have to have so many wind turbines. By the way, we have the best onshore wind, and we're building the nation's largest wind farm as well. But what the industry wants is a long-term plan that is doable, that attracts investment and allows an opportunity for innovation and research for improvements to be there. And that means...
Yeah, I hear you, but it just all the data points to the industry disappearing, not growing. And we haven't mentioned one human element, which is the health of the people who actually have to do this work. We spoke to Dr. David Blackley. He's an epidemiologist. He's with the National Institute of Occupational Health and Safety. He works in West Virginia on the resurgence of black lung disease. You know, and we spoke with a miner who was dying from it and didn't really even understand. He's a third generation. What he had and was coming to the slow realization, he didn't want his son to go into this. Are you concerned about that?
Well, of course, health is, you know, health and safety is the big issue. Now, we don't have, you know, because Wyoming has open pit mining. They're not underground mining. There's a big difference between open pit mining. But I would also point out that, you know, still roughly a little less than 40% of electricity in the world and in the nation are produced by coal. That is meets the hierarchy of needs, of food, water, shelter. You need that energy. I think it's very premature to say that coal is going by the way of the dodo bird. I think it's going to continue to be an important player and should be.
Yeah. Look, you mentioned expanding, your hopes to expand with the power plant out for now. And in your state, there's that court fight over federal mining leases in the Powder River Basin. A huge store of coal runs under Wyoming and Montana. A federal appeals court recently ruled that the Bureau of Land Management underestimated the environmental damage that would result from mining there. So as we said, big court fight here. What do you want to see?
Well, of course, we want to see people, you know, we want to see a victory on the side of coal for that. And I think when people take a look at our coal mines in Wyoming, you know, it's world-class reclamation. We improve the land after it is done. And so, you know, our view is we need energy, but you can't go forward without energy without taking into account environment, health, safety, reclamation. That all has to be part of the picture.
That's Matt Mead. He is governor of Wyoming. They are the biggest producer of coal in the country. They're also one of the states close to meeting requirements to reduce carbon emissions. Governor Mead, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Well, thanks, Robin. And in terms of the carbon emissions, I just want to say, you know, that's a process that we're working on because we think we want to have the coal for many years to come. And so we will continue to try to be a leader in that area.
Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you.
Your thoughts, coal for many years to come? Or is this chasing an industry that the market seems to indicate is going away? Your thoughts welcome at hereandnow.org.
A large part of 21st Century Fox could soon be owned by Disney. According to reports, the two companies have been talking not about selling all of Fox, but most of it, allowing Fox to focus more on sports and news rather than entertainment. Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Jeremy.
And we should be clear here, nothing is confirmed yet on this deal, but if it does go through, what might it look like?
Yeah, these are just talks, but there's increasing competition in the media industry between what you think of as traditional media, like Disney or Fox or CNN or NBC, and tech companies, right? Amazon, Google, Facebook, Netflix, things like that. So what's happening is it seems like Fox is understanding that, the scope and scale are important to making money and that they do certain things well and Disney does certain things well. So certain properties, like the movie properties, for instance, and entertainment properties, fit into Disney's portfolio better and are probably more valuable to Disney than they are to Fox. Fox, this sale, by the way, the reports of it would not involve Fox News or Fox Business Channel or Fox's local broadcasting affiliates. We're talking about the more traditional entertainment media properties.
And Fox then would become more focused on news
that.
And sports.
News and sports, right. And there's a way to make money out of news and sports, which is a real specialty. You'll notice that that's sort of been a common pairing. Now, obviously, Disney with ESPN has been very, very involved in sports, and that's why they wouldn't necessarily be interested in buying the ESPN, the Fox sports side of things. Regulators probably wouldn't allow that anyway. But there isn't an anti-competitive idea to Disney becoming bigger in the entertainment space and Fox becoming more focused on its news space, including, by the way, the Wall Street Journal.
So you don't think that there would be antitrust concerns on a deal like what we're talking about?
Well, I will say this. AT&T and Sprint are having antitrust concerns in the CNN deal, the Time Warner deal. I mean, there are always antitrust concerns, but the point is Disney and Fox are absolute competitors when it comes to sports. They're also competitors in the entertainment space, but Fox I think feels that it can focus its attention on news and sports and focus less on the other stuff. Fox is really, really trying to gain more exposure in the news space. It owns 39% of Sky in Europe. It owns Asia, Star TV. It's a real big player in the news space. Disney's a bigger player in the entertainment space.
How much of this has to do with the other new players in the entertainment space, and that would be Netflix and Amazon?
A lot, because they have substantially lower costs of distribution. So the only way you can fight the Amazons and the Netflixes and places like that is if you can be more nimble and you can reduce the costs of producing things. And basically, in this world, the way you reduce costs is scale. So when Disney gets bigger, it has the ability to negotiate prices lower for these things and stay in competition with the Netflixes and the Amazons of the world. Now, you brought up antitrust. That is one of those areas of concern where one would say, well, you're going to become too big, right, and too powerful and too influential in that space. But if I were the lawyer for Disney and this deal were on the table, I would say to the regulators, well, Netflix and Amazon are keeping us honest on that front. They're keeping competition going.
It's Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Ali, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
It's Here and Now. What will happen this winter in the Caribbean after Hurricanes Maria and Irma devastated many islands, including Puerto Rico? Well, the Caribbean Hotel and Tourism Association just announced that their late January to February previously scheduled conference in Puerto Rico will take place as planned, even though swaths of the island have no electricity. So what should you do? Well, there's a perception that the entire Caribbean is closed to tourism because of damage, but even some of the hardest hit islands are encouraging travelers. Please come. Jackie Gifford is travel director at Travel and Leisure magazine. She recently gave us an update, and we began by talking about the hardest hit areas.
Obviously, we keep seeing the coverage of Puerto Rico. The island continues to struggle. The British Virgin Islands were also affected. Also, the island of Anguilla, Barbuda was also deeply affected. St. Bart's, Dominica was also very badly hit. But we should point out that also there are many places that weren't affected at all, like Barbados, also Jamaica.
Well, let's say Antigua and Barbuda. This is a two-island nation.
Yes.
Barbuda is in ruins, sadly.
Yes, 90% of the people who live there are actually homeless right now. But Antigua was actually not that affected. The airport is open for business. Many of the hotels are getting ready to reopen again for the season. So Antigua is actually anticipating a bigger tourism season this year because they're going to be welcoming travelers from the other places, you know, people who have had their plans interrupted.
Yeah, and they're saying, in fact, that Antigua, a lot of the cruise itineraries had to change. And Antigua is one of the places where many ships will be heading. They may have a record breaking year for cruise tourism.
Exactly. And I should actually point out, I didn't mention this earlier, the U.S. Virgin Islands were also very affected.
Right.
You know, St. John was greatly impacted, but St. Croix wasn't hit as hard. And so you've got an iconic property like the Buccaneer. They're actually going to be open and welcoming visitors. But I should also point out that a lot of these properties are open and accepting, and they're having people stay there for the recovery effort. So workers who are there as part of the rebuilding process. So anybody who's thinking of traveling to one of the islands that is affected, the resorts aren't open for business as usual, shall we say.
Yeah, well, and just finishing the thought on Antigua and Barbuda.
Mm-hmm.
Barbuda is, you know, its star had been rising. It's very
yes.
small. And in fact, Robert De Niro and James Packer, who's the Australian businessman, were taking the former K Club Resort
mm-hmm.
and transforming it into the Paradise Found Nobu Resort when the hurricane hit. So
I know. Yeah. They're taking a step back. And actually, there was a small boutique property that opened there just a few years ago that Travel and Leisure put on its IT list called Barbuda Bell. It was a lovely, you know, boutique property with bungalows along the beach. Obviously, they were impacted. But you've got islands like the Cayman Islands. They weren't affected at all. And there was a new property that opened there called the Kimpton Seafire. It opened last year. And so we're seeing that a lot of the islands that were hurt, you know, people are going to start traveling elsewhere in the region.
keep talking about islands that might have had some damage, but maybe not devastation. Turks and Caicos.
Yeah, Turks is an interesting example. So the main island, Providenciales, Grace Bay, has long been a hub for tourism. There are many properties that line that beautiful stretch of beach. And, you know, they were able to get back on their feet relatively quickly, clean up the beaches. And so that Provo is open for business, but also Grand Turk, which is the hub really for the cruise business. That island, you know, they're still working on recovering. St. Barts is another example, too. You know, it was badly hit, but some of the shops and restaurants are slowly opening. Some of the more boutique, smaller properties, they're planning to open, I'd say, in March, April, start to welcome tourists. But some of the bigger places, like the iconic Eden Rock Hotel, which was, you know, it literally sat on a rock so close to the ocean, it's going to take a little bit of time before that reopens. But I should say they also have villas that are part of the hotel, and they are planning to open relatively soon.
So you mentioned that they still want people to come to some of these areas to maybe even volunteer. How do you know what's safe?
The key thing is to go to the Caribbean Tourism Organization's websites, to go to the Puerto Rico tourism website as well. And they've been really diligent about keeping people updated as to what is and what isn't open. I should also point out an interesting way to potentially visit Puerto Rico and help. I've been working on a story with the company called The Moorings. They do charter yacht sailings. And so the harbor is open and they're going to be welcoming cruise ships back in, it's looking like December. And The Moorings is anticipating that they're going to be able to start doing their charter sales again in December. So, you know, you can sail around the islands, maybe potentially visit Culebra and Vieques. But I don't want to, you know, minimize the situation on the ground at all. I mean, it's about bringing electricity back to the locals and delivering fresh water. That is the first order of business.
Well, but as you're saying, if the hotels aren't up, if you're staying
right.
on a charter boat,
right.
you can be staying there and then
exactly.
potentially go on shore and buy something.
Of course, and visit restaurants. You know, sometimes those are the first things to reopen. And, you know, that's the most important thing to realize is that when you're going and visiting, just be aware that it's not going to be the vacation perhaps that you had in mind last year. But it is important to still spend your dollars there.
Yeah. Jackie, with your expertise, what would you say is the best place that people should go? And, I hate to pick one, you know, out of all your Caribbean island children. But what is the best place where, you know, they may not have heard of
right.
it? I mean, an island you can shine a light on that maybe somebody might check out for the first time.
Barbados doesn't get as many American visitors. They get more Brits, to be honest. And the beaches are beautiful. The food is fantastic. I mean, nothing is unknown at this point. But I feel like because it's traditionally attracted Brits, Americans maybe just didn't know about it quite as much.
Okay, Barbados.
Yeah.
Jackie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's Jackie Gifford of Travel and Leisure Magazine. If you weren't taking notes, we'll have links at hereandnow.org. Well, from the Caribbean, we go to the farm fields of Arizona, where farmers are looking for innovative ways to meet increasing demand for food. And sometimes that innovation looks a lot like Silicon Valley high tech. Casey Kuhn from member station KJZZ visits a giant greenhouse in rural Arizona that's using artificial intelligence to better grow tomatoes.
Walking into tomato company Nature Sweet's greenhouse is like walking into Willy Wonka's chocolate factory. The long hall between the grow houses bustles with workers moving tomatoes and shouting directions. The general manager, Gustavo Vera, shows me rows of plants heavy with green-brown tomatoes. He says the eight-week process to get them to this point is done very carefully.
Growing tomatoes is an art. So the grower needs to balance out several conditions at the same time.
Conditions like humidity, temperature, irrigation, pest control, the list goes on. We're in one of the 16 greenhouses here where millions of tomatoes are grown to be sent to grocery stores nationwide. Nature Sweet is trying out a technology you may not expect to see in the rural Southwest, artificial intelligence.
This is going to revolutionize the industry, I believe, because what was an art now has a data backup.
Newly installed cameras line the greenhouses and take continuous photos of the crops, which then become data back at the main office. There, Veta shows me a dashboard on his computer, compiling and tracking the data coming from the growers.
And this tells us, okay, out of the houses that you have, which ones do have control operations?
He points to different charts and numbers that are constantly changing. An overhead shot shows not plants, but green dots in a row. He clicks on a data layer and a few turn red, meaning those plants have pests. Exact pinpoints show growers where to find the problem crops. But this artificial intelligence is not the kind that can take over the world, says agriculture technology specialist Robin Lawson.
Artificial intelligence has such this negative connotation. I immediately think of all of those sci-fi movies from Hollywood, and that's not what's happening.
She says it's large-scale data analytics that farmers are using nowadays as labor becomes more limited and expensive. In the past decade, robot sensors, aerial imagery, and hundreds of apps have helped farmers manage their fields. Lawson says cutting-edge technology and agriculture have always gone hand in hand, but now it's developing at a rapid pace.
And it's almost oversaturated data. There's some times where growers are like, this is too much. I don't even know how to put this together to make decisions.
That's not a problem at NatureSuite's Arizona greenhouse.
So we can all see it. So now the only thing is that I have to show you. If I can't show you on this one.
Irrigation technologist Juan Mosqueda inputs data about how fast the tomatoes are pruned and picked on an app on his phone. It's an upgrade from the pen and paper he used to use.
We don't have to carry any of the papers anymore. All the information is on the same place. It gives us some nice graphs when we go to it.
And as farming technology keeps getting smarter, tech specialist Robin Lawson says there may be a point where the plant itself, with a sensor in the seed, could tell a grower that it needs more water.
I think in the very near future that we're going to have sensors on each plant. In my lifetime, I think we'll start to see that.
It might be a while before that happens, but there's no doubt the future of farming is going digital. For Here and Now, I'm Casey Kuhn.
Tomorrow night, the country music community comes together for the CMA Awards, just a month or so after the mass shooting at a country music festival in Las Vegas. Last week, the Country Music Association said reporters at the CMAs should avoid questions about guns or politics or risk losing their credentials. The association has since reversed that decision. We're joined now by Don Cusick, professor of music business at Belmont University in Nashville. And Don, give us a sense of how big an issue guns are in country music right now after Las Vegas. Are people talking about them, or is this kind of a taboo subject?
Taboo subject. And, you know, country, the music is country, and that means rural. And so there's a long tradition of hunting and fishing and shooting guns. And, of course, basically a conservative group, they're going to believe in guns. Now, in terms of talking about it, this community has been hit pretty hard. The trauma, the fears are all there. So they may have gone out and bought some guns, but they're not really talking about guns or gun issues.
Well, why do you think that the Country Music Association initially said that it didn't want any questions to be asked about guns or politics at the CMA Awards?
I think it was a combination of good intentions. You know, there's a lot of trauma here, a lot of mental health issues with artists and crew members and all of that. And then wanting a warm and fuzzy show with, you know, you don't mess with the goose laying the golden egg. So you want it to be as happy and positive as possible.
Well, what does it tell you that Brad Paisley was the one? He's co-hosting the awards with Carrie Underwood. He tweeted out on Friday morning, "I'm sure the CMA will do the right thing and rescind these ridiculous and unfair press guidelines." And then they did.
Brad Paisley is a former student of mine, and I know he is a bright guy, and I know how he operates. It was a brilliant move. He didn't make any demands. He just chided them.
Do you think that they were justified in their fear that having an event that's not warm and fuzzy, as you say, would be a problem for sales?
I don't know about sales, but, you know, the artists are feeling very vulnerable now. They're vulnerable because they stand up on a stage with a spotlight in their eyes that, you know, you can't see anything beyond that spotlight. And they're vulnerable in their careers because if you remember the Dixie Chicks?
Yeah, with George W. Bush.
Yeah, if they say something that kind of cuts against their core audience, the career might be over. And finally, they're vulnerable because no matter what they say or do, nothing's going to happen. It can only be a negative.
What's the connection between country artists and the NRA?
Well, the NRA has a website called NRA Country. And it's a brilliant move by the NRA because here you have a controversial organization and country music has a very positive image. And so, you know, they're going to try and link the two. And by and large, the NRA's membership and the country music audience and country music community and artists overall fits to a large extent with that group. At the same time, most of the NRA members believe there should be some common sense rules about, you know, gun ownership. And certainly I would have to say country artists would feel the same way.
Beyond guns, the CMA also said initially, and again, they changed their mind on this, but that they wouldn't allow questions about politics. Makes me wonder how President Trump is seen in the country community at this point.
It's hard to talk about Trump down here because you've got a lot of people that are gung-ho for him, not just in the country music community, but in Tennessee, which is a very red state. And at the same time, sometimes he embarrasses them a bit with his tweets. But I think, you know, when you got a state that two-thirds, I believe, something like 60%, voted for Trump. And the tendency is to continue to support him.
So we shouldn't expect at the Country Music Association Awards to see anything like we did at the Emmys or the Oscars.
No, I don't think you're going to find that.
As a country music historian, have you seen a moment like this before where the news, where politics intersects so directly with country music and with Nashville?
Oh, yeah. Back in the 60s, country music was the counter to the counterculture. And here you have, you know, people living together without being married, free love, smoking that, you know, wearing those illegal smiles. And you have Merle Haggard come out with Okie from Muskogee. You know, in the anti-Vietnam demonstrations, you have some very pro-Army, very patriotic songs. Yeah, and of course, Alan Jackson, Where Were You When the World Stopped Turning? I mean, which is probably the greatest song about the 9/11 event that came out. So, you know, country has been, for a long time, commenting on the news or social events, but from the right side, right as in right political side.
That's Don Cusick, who is a professor at Belmont University who focuses on music history and the music business. Don, thanks so much as always.
Thank you, Jeremy. Great to be on.
And Hear It Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson, along with Robin Young. It's Hear It Now.